I can't remember his family name. He had big eyes that were beautiful in a feminine way, and he was terrified by the interrogation. There is no doubt that he had the gift of precognition, perhaps only in his then current state of excitement. More than once he went around the cell in the morning and pointed. "Today they are going to come for you and you. I saw it in my dream."
And they came and got them.
The very individuals he had pointed out. One might add that a prisoner's heart is so inclined toward mysticism that he accepts precognition almost without surprise. On July the 27th, Valentine came up to me. "Alexander, today it is our turn." And he told me a dream that had all the characteristics of prison dreams. A bridge across a muddy stream. A cross. I began to get my things together. And it was not for nothing either. He and I were summoned after morning tea. Our cellmates saw us off with noisy good wishes, and many of them assured us we were going off to freedom. They had figured it out by comparing our less serious cases. Perhaps you honestly don't believe it. Perhaps you won't allow yourself to believe. You can try to brush it aside with jokes. But flaming pincers, hotter than anything else on earth, suddenly close around your heart. They just do. Suppose it's true. They assembled 20 of us from various cells and took us to the baths first. Before every big change in his life, the prisoner has first of all to take a bath. We had time enough there, an hour and a half, to exchange our hunches and ideas. At that point, all steamed up, our skins tender. We were taken through the little emerald park in the Butyrki's interior courtyard, where the birds sang deafeningly, although they were probably only sparrows, and the green of the trees seemed unbearably bright to eyes no longer used to it. Never had my eyes seen the green of the leaves with such intensity as they did that spring, and never in my life had I seen anything closer to God's paradise than that little Butyrki park, which never took more than 30 seconds to cross on the asphalt path. Many years later, this time as a tourist, I saw another similar park, except that it was even smaller, in the Trubetskoy bastion of the Peter and Paul fortress in Leningrad. The other tourists exclaimed over the darkness of the corridors and cells, but I kept thinking to myself that with such a park to walk in, the prisoners of the Trubetskoy bastion were not lost men. We were taken out to walk only in deathly, cell-like stone enclosures. They took us to the Butyrki Station, a very well-chosen nickname for that reception and dispatch point, especially because its main hall was really like a good railroad station. They pushed us into a large, spacious box. It was half dark inside, and the air was clean and fresh. Since its one and only little window was very high up and had no muzzle, and it opened on that same sunny little park, and through the transom the birds twittered, deafened us, and in the opening a little bright green twig hung, promising us all freedom and home. We had never been in prison in such a good box, and that couldn't be a matter of chance. And we were all cases for the OSOs, the special boards attached to the GPUNKVD, and it turned out that each of us had been imprisoned for nothing much. No one touched us for 3 hours. No one opened the doors. We paced up and down the box, and finally, tired out, we sat down on the slab benches. And the little twig kept bobbing and bobbing outside the opening, and the sparrows screamed as if they were possessed. Suddenly the door crashed open, and one of us was summoned, a quiet bookkeeper, 35 years old. He went out. The door was locked. We started running about our box even more agitatedly than before. We were on hot coals. Once more, the crash of the door. They called another one out and readmitted the first. We rushed to him. But he was not the same man. The life had gone out of his face. His wide open eyes were unseeing. His movements were uncertain as he stumbled across the smooth floor of the box. Was he in a state of shock? Had they swatted him with an ironing board? "Well, well?" we asked him with sinking hearts. If he had not, in fact, just gotten up from the electric chair, he must at the very least have been given a death sentence. And in the voice of one reporting the end of the universe, the bookkeeper managed to blurt out, 5 years. And once more the door crashed. That was how quickly they returned, as if they were only being taken to the toilet to urinate. The second man returned, all aglow. Evidently he was being released.
Well, well, come on.
We swarmed around him, our hopes rising again. He waved his hand, choking with laughter. 15 years! It was just too absurd to be believed. Chapter 7. In the Engine Room. The box adjacent to the so-called Butyrki station was the famous frisking box where new arrivals were searched. It had space enough for 5 or 6 jailers to process up to 20 zeks in one batch. Now, however, it was empty, and the rough-hewn search tables had nothing on them. Over at one side of the room, seated behind a small nondescript table beneath a small lamp, was a neat, black-haired NKVD major. Patient boredom was what his face chiefly revealed. The intervals during which the zeks were brought in and led out one by one were a waste of his time. Their signatures could have been collected much, much faster. He indicated that I was to sit down on the stool opposite him, on the other side of his table. He asked my name. To the right and left of the inkwell lay 2 piles of white papers the size of a half sheet of typewriter paper, all looking much the same. In format, they were just like the fuel requisitions handed out in apartment house management offices, or warrants in official institutions for purchase of office supplies. Leafing through the pile on the right, the major found the paper which referred to me. He pulled it out and read it aloud to me in a bored patter. I understood I had been sentenced to 8 years. Immediately he began to write a statement on the back of it, with a fountain pen, to the effect that the text had been read to me on the particular date. My heart didn't give an extra half-beat. It was all so everyday and routine. Could this really be my sentence, the turning point in my life? I would have liked to feel nervous to experience this moment to the full, but I just couldn't. And the major had already pushed a sheet over to me, the blank side facing up, and a schoolchild's 7-kopeck pen with a bad point that had lint on it from the inkwell lay there in front of me. No, I have to read it myself. Do you really think I would deceive you? The major objected lazily. Well, go ahead, read it. Unwillingly, he let the paper out of his hand. I turned it over and began to look through it with deliberate slowness, not just word by word, but letter by letter. It had been typed, but what I had in front of me was not the original, but a carbon. Extract from a decree of the OSO of the NKVD of the USSR of July the 7th, 1945, number blank.
They had met to sentence me on the very day of the amnesty. The work must go on.
All of this was underscored with a dotted line, and the sheet was vertically divided with a dotted line. Case heard, on the left-hand side of the dotted line. Accusation of so-and-so, name, year of birth, place of birth. On the right-hand side of the dotted line, decreed. To designate for so-and-so, name, for anti-Soviet propaganda, and for an attempt to create an anti-Soviet organization, 8 years in corrective labor camps. Copy verified, secretary, and then his name. Was I really just supposed to sign and leave in silence? I looked at the major to see whether he intended to say something to me, whether he might not provide some clarification. No, he had no such intention. He had already nodded to the jailer at the door to get the next prisoner ready. To give the moment at least a little importance, I asked him, with a tragic expression, "But really, this is terrible. 8 years? What for?" And I could hear how false my own words sounded. Neither he nor I detected anything terrible. "Right there." The major showed me once again where to sign. I signed. I could simply not think of anything else to do. "In that case, allow me to write an appeal right here. After all, the sentence is unjust." "As provided by regulations," the major assented with a nod, placing my sheet of paper on the left-hand pile. "Let's move along," commanded the jailer. And I moved along. I had not really shown much initiative. Georgi Tenno, who to be sure had been handed a paper worth 25 years, answered, "After all, this is a life sentence. In olden times, they used to beat the drums and assemble a crowd when a person was given a life sentence. And here it's like being on a list for a soap ration. 25 years and run along." Arnold Rappaport took the pen and wrote on the back of the verdict, "I protest categorically this terroristic illegal sentence and demand immediate release." The officer who had handed it to him had at first waited patiently, but when he read what Rappaport had written, he was enraged and tore up the paper with the note on it. So what? The term remained in force anyway. This was just a copy. Vera Korneyeva was expecting 15 years, and she saw with delight that there was a typo on the official sheet. It read only 5. She laughed her luminous laugh and hurried to sign before they took it back. The officer looked at her dubiously. "Do you really understand what I read to you?" "Yes, yes, thank you very much. 5 years in corrective labor camps." The 10-year sentence of Janos Rojas, a Hungarian, was read to him in the corridor in Russian without any translation. He signed it, not knowing it was his sentence, and he waited a long time afterward for his trial. Still later, when he was in camp, he recalled the incident very vaguely and realized what had happened. I returned to the box with a smile. It was strange. Each minute I became jollier and more relieved. Everyone was returning with 10-ruble bills, including Valentin. The lightest term in our group that day had been given the bookkeeper who had gone out of his mind. He was still, in fact, beside himself. And the lightest term after his was mine. In the splashes of sun and the July breeze, the little twig outside the window continued to bob up and down as gaily as before. We chattered boisterously. Here and there, more and more frequently, laughter resounded in the box. We were laughing because everything had gone off so smoothly. We were laughing at the shocked bookkeeper. We were laughing at our morning hopes and at the way our cellmates had seen us off and arranged secret signals with us to be transmitted via food parcels. 4 potatoes or 2 bagels. "Well, anyway, there is going to be an amnesty," several affirmed. "All this is just for form's sake, and it doesn't mean anything. They want to give us a good scare, so we'll keep in line. Stalin told an American correspondent..." "What was his name?" "I don't remember his name." So they ordered us to take our things, formed us up by 2s, and led us once again through that same marvellous little park filled with summer. And where did they take us? Once again, to the baths. And oh, what a peal of laughter that got. My God, what silly nincompoops. Still roaring, we undressed, hung our duds on the same trolley hooks and rolled them into the same roaster they'd already been rolled into that very morning. Roaring, each of us took a small sliver of repulsive soap and went into the spacious, resonant shower room to wash off our girlish gaiety. We splashed about in there, pouring hot, clean water on ourselves, and we got to romping about as if we were school kids who had come to the baths after their last exam. This cleansing, relieving laughter was, I think, not really sick, but a living defense for the salvation of the organism. As we dried ourselves off, Valentin said to me reassuringly, intimately, "Well, all right, we're still young. We're going to live a long time yet. The main thing is not to make a misstep now. We are going to a camp, and will not say one word to anyone so they won't plaster new terms on us. We will work honestly, and keep our mouths shut." And he really believed in his program, that naive little kernel of grain caught between Stalin's millstones. He really had his hopes set on it. One wanted to agree with him, to serve out the term cosily, and then expunge from one's head what one had lived through. But I had begun to sense a truth inside myself. If, in order to live, it is necessary not to live, then what's it all for? One cannot really say that the OSO had been conceived after the revolution. Catherine the Great had sentenced the journalist Novikov, whom she disliked, to 15 years on, one might say, an OSO basis, since she didn't turn him over to a court. And all the Tsars, once in a while, in a fatherly way, exiled without any trial those who had incurred their displeasure. In the 1860s, a basic court reform took place. It seemed as if rulers and subjects had both begun to develop something like a juridical view of society. And yet in the 70s and 80s, Korolenko tracked down cases where administrative repression had usurped the role of judicial judgment. In 1872, he himself and 2 other students were exiled without trial on the orders of the Deputy Minister of State Properties. a typical case of an OSO. Another time, he and his brother were exiled without trial to Glazov. Korolenko has also given us the name of one Fyodor Bogdan, an emissary from the peasants, a Kodok, who got right up to the Tsar himself and was then exiled. And of Payankov, too, who was acquitted by a court, and yet exiled by order of the Tsar. And there were several others as well. And Vera Zatsulich explained in a letter sent after she emigrated that she had not run away from the court and a trial, but from non-judicial administrative repression. Thus, the tradition of the dotted line, the administratively issued sentence, dragged on. But it was too lax. It was suitable for a drowsy Asiatic country, but not for a country that was rapidly advancing. Moreover, it lacked any definite identity. Who was the OSO? Sometimes it was the Tsar, sometimes the governor, sometimes the deputy minister. And if it was still possible to enumerate names and cases, this was not, begging your pardon, real scope. Real scope entered the picture with the 20s, when permanently operating troikas, panels of three operating behind closed doors, were created to bypass the courts permanently. In the beginning, they even flaunted it proudly, the troika of the GPU. Not only did they not conceal the names of the members, they publicized them. Who on the Solovetsky Islands did not know the names of the famous Moscow troika, Gleb Boki, Bull, and Vasilyev? Yes, and what a word it was, in fact, troika. It bore a slight hint of sleigh bells on the shaft bow, the celebration of Shrovetide, and interwoven with all this a mystery. Why, troika? What did it mean? After all, a court wasn't a quartet, either. And a troika wasn't a court. And the biggest mystery of all lay in the fact that it was kept out of sight. We hadn't been there, we hadn't seen it. All we got was a piece of paper. Sign here. The troika was even more frightening than a revolutionary tribunal. It set itself even farther apart, muffled itself up, locked itself in a separate room, and, soon, concealed the names of its members. Thus we grew used to the idea that the troika members didn't eat or drink or move about among ordinary people. Once they had isolated themselves in order to go into session, they were shut off for good, and all we knew of them were the sentences handed out through typists. And they had to be returned, too. Such documents couldn't be left in the hands of individuals. These troikas, we use the plural just in case, because, as with a deity, we never know where or in what form it exists, satisfied a persistent need that had arisen, never to allow those arrested to return to freedom. This was like an OTK, a Department for Quality Control in Industry, but in this case it was attached to the GPU to prevent any spoiled goods. If it turned out that someone was innocent and could therefore not be tried at all, then let him have his minus 32 via the troika, which meant he couldn't live in any of the provincial capitals, or let him spend 2 or 3 years in exile, after which he would have a convict's clipped ear, would always be a marked man, and from then on a recidivist. Please forgive us, reader, we have once more gone astray with this rightist opportunism, this concept of guilt, and of the guilty or innocent. It has, after all, been explained to us that the heart of the matter is not personal guilt, but social danger. One can imprison an innocent person if he is socially hostile, and one can release a guilty man if he is socially friendly. But lacking legal training, we can be forgiven. For the 1926 code, according to which, my good fellow, we lived for 25 years and more, was itself criticized for an impermissible bourgeois approach, for an insufficiently class-conscious approach, and for some kind of bourgeois weighing of punishments in relation to the gravity of what had been committed. Alas, it is not for us to write the absorbing history of this particular organ, how the troikas turned into OSOs, or when they got renamed, or whether there were OSOs in provincial centres, or just one of them in the Great Palace, or which of our great and proud leaders were members, or how often they met and how long their sessions lasted, whether or not they were served tea while they worked, and if they were, what was served with the tea, and how the work itself proceeded, did they converse while it was going on or not. We are not the ones who will write this history because we don't know. All that we have heard is that the essence of the OSO was triune, and even though it is still impossible to name its industrious members, yet we do know the three organs permanently represented there. One member represented the Central Committee of the Party, one the MVD, and one the Chief Prosecutor's Office. However, it would not be a miracle if we should learn some day that there were never any sessions, and that there was only a staff of experienced typists composing extracts from non-existent records of proceedings, and one general administrator who directed the typists. As for typists, there were certainly typists, that we can guarantee. Up to 1924, the authority of the Troika was limited to sentences of 3 years maximum. From 1924 on, they moved up to 5 years of camp. From 1937 on, the OSO could turn out 10-ruble bills. After 1948, they could rivet a quarter, 25 years, on you. And there are people, Chavdarov, for example, who know that during the war years the OSO even sentenced prisoners to execution by shooting. Nothing unusual about this. The OSO was nowhere mentioned in either the Constitution or the Code. However, it turned out to be the most convenient kind of hamburger machine, easy to operate, undemanding, and requiring no legal lubrication. The Code existed on its own, and the OSO existed on its own, and it kept on deftly grinding without all the Code's 205 articles, neither invoking them nor even mentioning them. As they used to joke in camp, there is no court for nothing, for that there is an OSO. Of course, the OSO itself also needed for convenience some kind of operational shorthand, but for that purpose it worked out on its own a dozen letter articles which made operations very much simpler. It wasn't necessary when they were used to cudgel your brains trying to make things fit the formulations of the code, and they were few enough to be easily remembered by a child. Some of them we have already described: ASA, Anti-Soviet Agitation, KRD, Counter-Revolutionary Activity, KRTD, Counter-Revolutionary Trotskyite Activity, and that T made the life of a Zek in camp much harder. PSH, Suspicion of Espionage. Espionage that went beyond the bounds of suspicion was handed over to tribunal. SVPSH, Contacts Leading to Suspicion of Espionage. KRM, Counter-Revolutionary Thought. VAS, Dissemination of Anti-Soviet Sentiments. SOE, Socially Dangerous Element. SBE, Socially Harmful Element. PD, Criminal Activity. A favorite accusation against former camp inmates if there was nothing else to be used against them. And then, finally, there was the very expansive category. CHS. Member of a family, of a person convicted under one of the foregoing letter categories. It has to be remembered that these categories were not applied uniformly and equally among different groups and in different years, but, as with the Articles of the Code and the sections in special decrees, they broke out in sudden epidemics. There is one more qualification. The OSO did not claim to be handing down a sentence. It did not sentence a person, but instead imposed an administrative penalty. And that was the whole thing in a nutshell. Therefore it was, of course, natural for it to have juridical independence. But even though they did not claim that the administrative penalty was a court sentence, it could be up to 25 years and include deprivation of titles, ranks, and decorations, confiscation of all property, imprisonment, deprivation of the right to correspond. Thus a person could disappear from the face of the earth with the help of the OSO even more reliably than under the terms of some primitive court sentence. The OSO enjoyed another important advantage in that its penalty could not be appealed. There was nowhere to appeal to. There was no appeals jurisdiction above it, and no jurisdiction beneath it. It was subordinate only to the Minister of Internal Affairs, to Stalin, and to Satan. Another big advantage the OSO had was speed. This speed was limited only by the technology of typewriting. And last but not least, not only did the OSO not have to confront the accused face-to-face, which lessened the burden on inter-prison transport, it didn't even have to have his photograph. At a time when the prisons were badly overcrowded, this was a great additional advantage because the prisoner did not have to take up space on the prison floor or eat free bread once his interrogation had been completed. He could be sent off to camp immediately and put to honest work. The copy of the sentence could be read to him much later. It used to be that in favorable conditions the prisoners were unloaded from freight cars at their destinations, and they were made to kneel down right there, next to the tracks, as a precaution against attempted escape. But it looked as if they were praying to the OSO, and then and there their sentences were read out to them. It could also happen differently. In 1938, those who arrived at Peribori on prisoner transports did not know either their code articles or their sentences, but the clerk who met them knew, and he looked them up on the list. SVE, socially harmful element, 5 years. That was during the time when there was an urgent need for many hands to work on the Moscow-Volga Canal. Others worked in the camps for months without knowing their sentences. After this, as I. Dobriak reported, they were solemnly lined up, and not just on any old day, but on May the 1st, 1938, when the red flags were flying, and the Stalino Province Troika's sentences were announced. This would indicate that the OSO did get decentralized in times of heavy load. These sentences were from 10 to 20 years apiece, and in that same year my former camp foreman, Sinebryokov, was sent off with a whole trainload of unsentenced prisoners from Chelyabinsk to Cherepovets. Months passed and the Zeks worked away, and then one rest day in winter. Note the days, another advantage of the OSO. When the frost was cracking, they were driven out into the courtyard and lined up. A newly arrived lieutenant appeared and introduced himself as having come to inform them of their OSO penalties. But he turned out to be a decent sort because he squinted at their thin footwear and at the sun's rays in the steaming frost and said, "Well, anyway, men, why should you freeze out here? The OSO gave you all 10 years apiece. There are just a very, very few who got 8. You understand? Disperse." But in view of the frankly mechanical operation of the special board, why have any courts at all? Why use a horse car when there's a noiseless modern streetcar available, which no one can jump out of? Is it a matter of keeping the judges well fed? Still, it is really quite indecent for a democratic state not to have courts. In 1919, the 8th Congress of the party proclaimed in its program, "Efforts must be made to involve all the working population in the exercise of judicial duties." It did not prove possible to involve all the working population. Conducting a trial is a delicate business, but there was no question of getting along entirely without courts. However, our political courts, the special collegia of provincial courts, the military tribunals, and why actually should there be military tribunals in peacetime anyway? And all the supreme courts, too, unanimously followed the path of the OSO. They, too, did not get stuck in the mud of public trials or in arguments between sides. Their primary and principal distinguishing feature was closed doors. They were, first of all, closed courts, for their own convenience. And by now we have become so accustomed to the fact that millions and millions of people were tried in closed sessions, and have become used to this for so long that now and then some mixed-up son, brother, or nephew of a prisoner will even snort at you with conviction. "And what would you have wanted? There's information here. Our enemies will find out. You can't do it." Thus the fear that our enemies will find out makes us clamp our head between our own knees. Who in our fatherland, except some bookworms, remembers now that Karakozov, who fired at the Tsar, was provided with a defense lawyer? Or that Zhelyabov and all the Narodnaya Volya group were tried in public, without any fear that the Turks would find out? Or that Vera Zasulish, who attempted to kill the official who was, translated in Soviet terms, the chief of the Moscow administration of the MVD, although she missed and the bullet went past his head, not only was not destroyed in a torture chamber, but was acquitted in open court by a jury, no troika, and then went off in triumph in a carriage. Despite these comparisons, I do not at all mean to say that a perfect system of courts and justice ever existed in Russia. In all probability, an excellent judicial system is the last fruit of the most mature society, or else one needs a Solomon. Vladimir Dahl notes that in the period before the emancipation of the serfs, Russia had not one single proverb containing any praise of the courts. And that really means something. It seems likely that they never had time to get around to making up a proverb praising the zemstvo chiefs, either. But, nevertheless, the judicial reform of 1864 at least set the urban sector of our society on the road toward those English models which Herzen praised so highly. Saying all this, I still have not forgotten what Dostoevsky had to say in his Diary of a Writer against our trials by jury, about the excesses of some lawyer's eloquence. "Gentlemen of the jury, what kind of woman would she have been if she had not stabbed her rival? Gentlemen of the jury, who among you would not have thrown the child out of the window?" And the risk that a juror's momentary impulse might outweigh his civic responsibility. But spiritually, Dostoevsky far outstripped the realities of our life, and he worried about what he shouldn't have worried about. He believed that we had achieved open trials once and for all. Indeed, who among his contemporaries could have believed in the OSO? And somewhere else he writes, "It is better to err on the side of mercy than on that of the death penalty." Oh, yes, yes, yes. Excesses of eloquence do not afflict exclusively a judicial system in process of being established. Even more conspicuously, they afflict an already established democracy that has not yet discovered its moral goals. England again gives us examples, as when, for partisan advantage, the leader of the opposition does not hesitate to blame the government for a national predicament worse than actually exists. Excesses of eloquence are a malady, but what word can we then use for the excessive use of closed doors? Dostoevsky dreamed of a court in which everything essential to the defense of the accused would be set forth by the prosecutor. How many eons will we have to wait for that? Our social experience has so far enriched us immeasurably with defense lawyers who accuse the defendant. As an honest Soviet person, as a true patriot, I cannot but feel repugnance at the disclosure of these evil deeds. And how comfortable it all is for the judges in a closed session. Judicial robes are not required, and one can even roll up one's sleeves. How easy it is to work. There are no public address systems, no newspaper men, and no public. Well, there is a public, an audience, but it consists of interrogators. For example, they used to attend the Leningrad province court during the day to find out how their protégés were conducting themselves, and at night went calling on those prisoners who needed to have their consciences appealed to. C.H. Blank N's group. The second main characteristic of our political courts is the lack of ambiguity in their work, which is to say, predetermined verdicts. That same collection, edited by A.Y. Vyshinsky, includes materials indicating that the predetermination of verdicts is an old, old story. In 1924 to 1929, sentences were determined by joint administrative and economic considerations. Beginning in 1924, because of national unemployment, the courts reduced the number of verdicts which sentenced prisoners to corrective labor while they continued to live at home and increased short-term prison sentences. These cases involved only non-political offenders, of course. As a result, prisons were overcrowded with short-termers serving sentences of up to 6 months, and not enough use was being made of them in labor colonies. At the beginning of 1929, the People's Commissariat of Justice of the USSR, in Circular No. 5, condemned short-term sentences, and on November the 6th, 1929, the eve of the 12th anniversary of the October Revolution, when the country was supposedly entering on the construction of socialism, a decree of the Central Executive Committee and the Council of People's Commissars simply forbade all sentences of less than 1 year. In other words, you, a judge, always know what the higher-ups expect of you. Furthermore, there's a telephone if you still have any doubts. And following the example of the OSOs, sentences might even be typed out ahead of time, with only the prisoner's name to be added later by hand. And in 1942, Strakovich cried out during a session of the military tribunal of the Leningrad military district, "But I could not have been recruited by Ignatovsky when I was only 10 years old." But the presiding judge barked back, "Don't slander the Soviet intelligence service." The whole thing had been predetermined long before. Each and every one of the Ignatovsky group was to be sentenced to be shot. Some man named Lipov got included in the group, but no one from the group knew him, and he knew none of them either. Well, so, all right, Lipov got 10 years. How hugely the predetermination of sentences contributed to easing the thorny life of a judge. It wasn't so much a mental relief, in the sense that one didn't have to think, as it was a moral relief. You didn't have to torture yourself with worry that you might make a mistake in a sentence and make orphans out of your own little children. And the predetermination of sentences could dispose even so immovable a judge as Ulrich to good humour. And what major execution had he not pronounced? In 1945, the military collegium was hearing the case of the Estonian separatists. Short, stocky, good-humoured Ulrich was presiding. He didn't pass up a single opportunity to joke not only with his colleagues but also with the prisoners. After all, that's what humaneness is, a new trait. Where had it ever been seen? Having learned that Susi was a lawyer, he said to him with a smile, "Well, so now your profession can be of some use to you." "Well, there is no need to quarrel. Why be embittered? The court routine proceeded pleasantly. They smoked right at the judge's table, and at a convenient moment broke off for a good lunch. And when evening began to fall, they had to go and confer. But who confers at night? They left the prisoners to sit at their desks all night long and went on home. At 9 in the morning they came in, all brisk and freshly shaved. "Rise, the court is in session." And all the prisoners were given a 10-ruble bill apiece. And if anyone should object that the OSO at least proceeded without hypocrisy, whereas there was hypocrisy in instances like the above, they pretended to be conferring, but didn't really confer. We would certainly have to enter a strong, very strong, dissent. Well, the third and final characteristic is dialectics, which used to be crudely described in the folk saying, "Whichever way you point a wagon tongue, that's the way it goes." The code cannot be a dead weight in the path of the judge. The articles of the code had been around during 10, 15, 20 years of rapid change, and just as Faust said, "The whole world changes and everything moves forward, and why should I be afraid to break my word?" All the articles of the code had become encrusted with interpretations, directions, instructions, and if the actions of the accused are not covered by the code, he can still be convicted. By analogy, what opportunities? Simply because of origins, 735, belonging to a socially dangerous milieu. In the Republic of South Africa, terror has gone to such lengths in recent years that every suspicious SDE, socially dangerous element, black, can be arrested and held for 3 months without investigation or trial. Anyone can see immediately the flimsiness of this. Why not from 3 to 10 years? For contacts with dangerous persons, this is something we hadn't known, something the newspaper Izvestia told us in July 1957. Here's scope for you. Who is dangerous and what contacts consist of only the judge can say. But one should not complain about the precise wording of our published laws either. On January the 13th, 1950, a decree was issued re-establishing capital punishment. One is bound, of course, to consider that capital punishment never did depart from Beria's cellars. And the decree stated that the death sentence could be imposed on subversives, diversionists. What did that mean? It didn't say. Yosif Vissarionovich loved it that way. Not to say all of it, just to hint. Did it refer only to someone who blew up rails with TNT? It didn't say. We had long since come to know what a diversionist was, Someone who produced goods of poor quality was a diversionist. But what was a subversive? Was someone subverting the authority of the government, for example, in a conversation on a streetcar? Or if a girl married a foreigner, wasn't she subverting the majesty of our motherland? But it is not the judge who judges. The judge only takes his pay. The directives did the judging. The directive of 1937, 10 years, 20 years, execution by shooting. The directive of 1943, 20 years at hard labour, hanging. The directive of 1945, 10 years for everyone, plus 5 of disenfranchisement, manpower for 3 5-year plans. Babayev, in fact a non-political, shouted at them, "You can muzzle me for 300 years, but I'll never lift my hand for you, you benefactors." The directive of 1949, everyone gets 25. Thus it was that a real spy, Schultz in Berlin in 1948, could get 10 years, and someone who had never been a spy, Günter Waschkau, got 25, because he was in the wave of 1949. The machine stamped out the sentences. The prisoner had already been deprived of all right when they cut off his buttons on the threshold of state security, and he couldn't avoid a stretch. The members of the legal profession were so used to this that they fell on their faces in 1958 and caused a big scandal. The text of the projected new Fundamental Principles of Criminal Prosecution of the USSR was published in the newspapers, and they'd forgotten to include any reference to possible grounds for acquittal. The government newspaper issued a mild rebuke. "The impression might be created that our courts only bring in convictions." Izvestia, September the 10th, 1958. But just take the jurist's side for a moment. Why, in fact, should a trial be supposed to have two possible outcomes when our general elections are conducted on the basis of one candidate? An acquittal is, in fact, unthinkable from the economic point of view. It would mean that the informers, the security officers, the interrogators, the prosecutor's staff, the internal guard in the prison, and the convoy had all worked to no purpose. Here is one straightforward and typical case that was brought before a military tribunal. In 1941, the security operations branch of our inactive army stationed in Mongolia was called on to show its activity and vigilance. The military medical assistant, Lozovsky, who was jealous of Lieutenant Pavel Chulpenyev because of some woman, realized this. He addressed 3 questions to Chulpenyev when they were alone. 1. Why, in your opinion, are we retreating from the Germans? Chulpenyev's reply. They have more equipment, and they were mobilized earlier. Lozovsky's counter. No, it's a maneuver. We're decoying them. 2. Do you believe the Allies will help? Chulpenyev. I believe they'll help, but not from unselfish motives. Losovsky's counter. They are deceiving us. They won't help us at all. 3. Why was Voroshilov sent to command the Northwest Front? Chulpenyev answered and forgot about them, and Losovsky wrote a denunciation. Chulpenyev was summoned before the political branch of the division and expelled from the Komsomol for a defeatist attitude, for praising German equipment, for belittling the strategy of our high command. The loudest voice raised against him belonged to the Komsomol organizer Kalyagin, who had behaved like a coward at the Battle of Kalkin Gol in Chulpenyev's presence, and therefore found it convenient to get rid of the witness once and for all. Chulpenyev's arrest followed. He had one confrontation with Lozovsky. Their previous conversation was not even brought up by the interrogator. 1 question was asked. Do you know this man? Yes. Witness, you may leave. The interrogator was afraid the charge might fall through. Today, Lozovsky holds the degree of candidate in medical sciences and lives in Moscow. Everything is going well with him. Chulpenyev drives a trolley bus. Depressed by his month's incarceration in the sort of hole in the ground we have already described, Chulpenyev appeared before a military tribunal of the 36th Motorized Division. Present were Lebedev, the divisional political commissar, and Slesarev, the chief of the political branch. The witness Lazovsky was not even summoned to testify. However, after the trial to document the false testimony, they got Lazovsky's signature and that of political commissar Sergeyevgin. The questions the tribunal asked were, did you have a conversation with Lazovsky? What did he ask you about? What were your answers? Naively, Chulpenyev told them. He still couldn't understand what he was guilty of. After all, many people talk like that, he innocently exclaimed. The tribunal was interested. Who? Give us their names. But Chulpenyev was not of their breed. He had the last word. I beg the court to give me an assignment that will mean my death, so as to assure itself once more of my patriotism. And like a simple-hearted warrior of old, me and the person who slandered me, both of us together. Oh, no. Our job is to kill off all those chivalrous sentiments in the people. Lasovsky's duty was to hand out pills, and Sergeyevgin's duty was to indoctrinate the soldiers. Viktor Andreevich Sergeyevgin lives in Moscow today and works in a consumer service combine attached to the Moscow Soviet. He lives well. Whether or not you died wasn't important. What was important was that we were on our guard. The members of the military tribunal went out, had a smoke, and returned. 10 years plus 3 years disenfranchisement. There were certainly more than 10 such cases in every division during the war. Otherwise, the military tribunals would not have justified the cost of maintaining them. And how many divisions were there in all? Let the reader count them up himself. The sessions of the military tribunals were depressingly like one another. The judges were depressingly faceless and emotionless, rubber stamps. The sentences all came off the same assembly line. Everyone maintained a serious mien, but everyone understood it was a farce, above all the boys of the convoy who were the simplest sort of fellows. At the Novosibirsk transit prison in 1945, they greeted the prisoners with a roll call based on cases. So-and-so, Article 58, 1A, 25 years. The chief of the convoy guard was curious. What did you get it for? For nothing at all. You're lying. The sentence for nothing at all is 10 years. When the military tribunals were under pressure, their sessions lasted 1 minute, the time it took them to go out and come in again. When their working day went on for 16 consecutive hours, one could see, through the door of the conference room, bowls of fruit on a table set with a white tablecloth. If they weren't in a hurry, they enjoyed delivering their sentence with a psychological twist. Sentenced to the supreme measure of punishment, and then a pause. The judges would look the condemned man in the eye. It was interesting to see how he took it. What was he feeling at that moment? Only then would the verdict continue. But taking into consideration the sincere repentance. On the walls of the waiting room, messages had been scratched with nails and scrawled in pencil. I got execution. I got 25. I got a tenner. They didn't clean off these graffiti. They served an educational purpose. Be scared. Bow down. Don't think that you can change anything by your behavior. Even if you were to speak in your own defense with the eloquence of Demosthenes, in a hall empty except for a handful of interrogators, like Olga Sliudsberg in 1936 at the Supreme Court, it would not help you in the slightest. All you could do would be to increase your sentence from 10 years to execution. For instance, if you were to shout, "You are fascists! I am ashamed to have been a member of your party for several years!" Nikolai Semyonovich Daskal did it in 1937 at the Special Collegium of the Azov Black Sea province at Maikop, presided over by Kholik. In that situation, what they did was fabricate a new case and do you in once and for all. Chavdarov has described an incident in which the accused suddenly repudiated at their trial all the false testimony they had given during their interrogation. And what happened? If there was any hesitation while glances were exchanged, it lasted no more than a few seconds. The prosecutor asked for a recess without explaining why. The interrogators and their tough boy helpers dashed in from the interrogation prison. All the prisoners, distributed among separate boxes, were given a good beating all over again and promised another after the next recess. The recess came to an end. Once again, the judges questioned all of them, and this time they all confessed. Alexander Grigorievich Karetnikov, the director of the Textile Research Institute, provided an example of outstanding astuteness. Just before the session of the military collegium of the Supreme Court was to begin, he sent word through the guard that he wanted to give supplementary testimony. This, of course, provoked curiosity. He was received by the prosecutor. Karetnikov displayed his infected collarbone, broken by the interrogator who had struck him with a stool, and declared, "I signed everything under torture." By this time the prosecutor was cursing himself for having been so greedy to get supplementary testimony. But it was too late. Each of them is fearless only as long as he is an anonymous cog in the whole machine. But just as soon as the responsibility has become personalized, individualized, concentrated on him, just as soon as the searchlight is on him, he grows pale and realizes that he is nothing and can slip on any chance banana peel. So Karetnikov caught the prosecutor, and the latter was unwilling to suppress the whole business. The session of the military collegium began, and Karetnikov repeated his statement in front of them. Now there was a case in which the military collegium went out and really conferred. But the only verdict they could have brought in was acquittal, which would have meant releasing Karetnikov on the spot. Therefore, they brought in no verdict at all. As if nothing at all had happened, they took Karetnikov back to prison, treated his collarbone, and kept him another 3 months. A very polite new interrogator entered the case, who wrote out a new warrant for Karetnikov's arrest. If the collegium had not twisted things, he might at least have spent those 3 months as a free man. The interrogator asked the same questions as the first interrogator. Karetnikov, sensing freedom in the offing, conducted himself staunchly and refused to admit any guilt whatsoever. And what happened next? He got 8 years from an OSO. This example shows well enough the possibilities available to the prisoner and the possibilities available to the OSO. It was the poet Derzhavin who wrote, "A partial court is worse than banditry. Judges are enemies, there sleeps the law. In front of you, the citizen's neck lies stretched out, quiet and without defense." But it was a rare thing for such accidents to take place in the military collegium of the Supreme Court. For that matter, it was in general rare for it to rub clear its clouded eyes and take a look at any individual little tin soldier of a prisoner. In 1937, A.D.R., an electrical engineer, was taken up to the fourth floor, running upstairs with a convoy guard on either side of him. In all probability the elevator was working, but there were so many prisoners pouring in and out that the officials and employees would not have been able to use the elevator if the prisoners had been permitted to. Meeting a convicted prisoner who had just left, they dashed into the court. The military collegium was in such a hurry, they hadn't sat down yet, and all three members remained standing. Catching his breath with difficulty, for he had been weakened by his long interrogation, R. blurted out his full name. They muttered something, exchanged glances, and Ulrich, the very same, no less, proclaimed, 20 years! And they dragged R. out at a gallop, and at a gallop dragged in the next prisoner. It was all like a dream. In February 1963, I, too, got to climb those stairs, but I was courteously accompanied by a colonel, who was also a Communist Party organizer. And in that room with the circular colonnade, in which, they say, the plenary sessions of the Supreme Court of the USSR meet, with an enormous horseshoe-like table that had another round table inside it and 7 antique chairs, 70 officials of the military collegium heard me out, that same military collegium which once sentenced Karetnikov and R., and others, and so on, and so forth. And I said to them, "What a remarkable day this is. Although I was first sentenced to camp and then to eternal exile, I never before saw a single judge face to face, and now I see all of you assembled here together." And they, rubbing their eyes open for the first time, saw a living Zek. But it turned out that it had not been they. Yes. They said it had not been they. They assured me that those others were no longer present. Some had retired honorably on pensions. A few had been removed. Ulrich, the outstanding executioner of all, had been removed, it turned out, back in Stalin's time in 1950. For, believe it or not, leniency. Some of them, there were only a few of these, had even been tried under Khrushchev, and in their role as defendants, they had threatened, "Today you are trying us, tomorrow we will try you. Watch out." But like all the starts made under Khrushchev, this effort too, which had been very active at first, was soon abandoned. He dropped it before it got far enough to produce an irreversible change, which meant that things were left where they had been. On that occasion, several veterans of the bench, all speaking up at the same time, gave voice to their recollections, unwittingly providing me with material for this chapter. Oh, if only they had undertaken to remember and to publish. But the years pass, another 5 have gone by, and it has not become any brighter or lighter. They recalled how certain judges, at conferences of their judicial colleagues, took pride when they spoke from the rostrum of having succeeded in not applying Article 51 of the Criminal Code, which specifies those circumstances that extenuate guilt, and thus had succeeded in handing down sentences of 25 years instead of 10, and how the courts had been humiliatingly subservient to the organs. A certain judge was trying a case. A Soviet citizen who had returned from the United States had made the slanderous statement that there were good automobile roads in America, and nothing else. That was all there was to the case. The judge ventured to send the case back for further investigation for the purpose of getting genuine anti-Soviet materials. In other words, so that the accused could be beaten and tortured. But his praiseworthy intention wasn't taken into account. The angry answer came back, "You mean you don't trust our organs?" And, in the upshot, the judge was exiled to the post of secretary of a military tribunal on Sakhalin. Under Khrushchev, reproof was not so severe. Judges who made mistakes were sent, where do you think, to work as lawyers. Izvestia, June the 9th, 1964. This throws an interesting light on views of legal defense. In 1918, V.I. Lenin demanded that judges who handed down sentences that were too lenient be excluded from the party. The prosecutor's office was just as subservient to the organs. When in 1942 Ryomin's flagrant abuses in the counterintelligence section of the Northern Fleet became known, the prosecutor's office did not dare interfere on its own, but only reported respectfully to Abakumov that his boys were acting up. Abakumov had good reason to consider the organs the salt of the earth. This was the occasion when he called in Ryumin and promoted him to his own eventual undoing. There just wasn't enough time that February day, or they would have told me 10 times as much as they did. But this, too, provides food for thought. If both the courts and the prosecutor's office were simply pawns of the Minister of State Security, then maybe there isn't any need for a separate chapter to describe them. They vied with each other in telling me things, and I kept looking around me in astonishment. They were people, real people. They were smiling. They were explaining that their intentions were of the best. Well, and what if things turn full circle, and it is once again up to them to try me? Maybe even in that very hall. And they were showing me the main hall. Well, so they will convict me. Which comes first, the chicken or the egg? The people or the system? For several centuries we had a proverb, don't fear the law, fear the judge. But in my opinion, the law has outstripped people, and people have lagged behind in cruelty. It is time to reverse the proverb, don't fear the judge, fear the law. Abakumov's kind of law, of course. They stepped onto the rostrum and talked about Ivan Denisovich. They said happily that the book had eased their consciences. That's what they said. They admitted that the picture I painted was decidedly on the bright side, that every one of them knew of camps worse than that. Ah, so they did know. Of the 70 people seated around that horseshoe, several turned out to be knowledgeable in literature, even to be readers of Novi Mir. They were eager for reform. They spoke forcefully about our social ulcers, about our neglect of our rural areas. And I sat there and thought, if the first tiny droplet of truth has exploded like a psychological bomb, what then will happen in our country when whole waterfalls of truth burst forth? And they will burst forth. It has to happen. Chapter 8. The Law as a Child. We forget everything. What we remember is not what actually happened, not history, but merely that hackneyed, dotted line they have chosen to drive into our memories by incessant hammering. I do not know whether this is a trait common to all mankind, but it is certainly a trait of our people, and it is a vexing one. It may have its source in goodness, but it is vexing nonetheless. It makes us an easy prey for liars. Therefore, if they demand that we forget even the public trials, we forget them. The proceedings were open and were reported in our newspapers, but they didn't drill a hole in our brains to make us remember, and so we've forgotten them. Only things repeated on the radio day after day drill holes in the brain. I am not even talking about young people, since they, of course, know nothing of all this, but about people who were alive at the time of those trials. Ask any middle-aged person to enumerate the highly publicized open trials. He will remember those of Bukharin and Zinoviev, and knitting his brow, that of the Prompt Party, too. And that's all. There were no other public trials. Yet in actual fact they began right after the October Revolution. In 1918, quantities of them were taking place in many different tribunals. They were taking place before there were either laws or codes, when the judges had to be guided solely by the requirements of the revolutionary workers' and peasants' power. At the same time, they were regarded as blazing their own trail of bold legality. Their detailed history will some day be written by someone, and it's not for us even to attempt to include it in our present investigation. However, we cannot do without a brief review. It is our duty, anyway, to probe some of the charred ruins which go all the way back to that gentle, misty, rose-coloured dawn. In those dynamic years, the sabres of war were not rusting in their scabbards, nor did the executioner's revolvers have time to grow cold in their holsters. Only later on did the custom develop of hiding executions in cellars under cover of night, and of shooting the victims in the back of the head. In 1918, the famous Ryazan Chekist Stelmach had those sentenced to death shot in the courtyard during the day, so that prisoners awaiting execution could watch from the prison windows. There was an official term current then, extrajudicial reprisal. Not because there weren't any courts at the time, but because there was the Cheka. This fledgling whose beak had not yet hardened was warmed and encouraged by Trotsky. Terror is a powerful means of policy, and one would have to be a hypocrite not to understand this. And Zinoviev rejoiced too, not yet foreseeing his own end. The letters GPU, like the letters VCHK, are the most popular in the world. Because it was more efficient. Certainly, there were courts, and they tried and convicted and executed people, but we need to remember that parallel to them, and independently of them, extrajudicial reprisal went on at the same time. How can one depict its scale? M. Latsis, in his popular review of the Cheka's activity, gives us material for only a year and a half, 1918 and half of 1919, and for only 20 provinces of central Russia. The figures presented here are far from complete. In part, perhaps, out of modesty. Those shot by the Cheka, that is, without trial, bypassing the courts, numbered 8,389 persons. 8,389. Counter-revolutionary organizations uncovered 412, a fantastic figure in view of our inadequate capacity for organization throughout our history, and also the general isolation of individuals in those years, and the general psychological depression. The total of those arrested, 87,000. And this figure smells of understatement. What comparison is available for purposes of evaluation? In 1907, a group of leftist leaders published a collection of essays entitled Against Capital Punishment, in which are listed by name all those sentenced to death in Tsarist Russia from 1826 to 1906. The editors qualify their findings with the statement that there were some additional victims whose names remain unknown, and that the list is incomplete. However, it is certainly not so incomplete as Latsis's materials compiled during the Civil War. The list totals 1,397, from which 233 persons have to be deducted because their death sentences were commuted, as do an additional 270 who were sentenced in absentia and never caught, for the most part Polish rebels who had fled to the West. That leaves 894, a figure covering 80 years, which is not even close to Latsis's total for only 1.5 years, and not including all the provinces of Russia either. True, the editors of the collection cite another presumed statistic of 1,310 for those sentenced to death, although perhaps not executed, in 1906 alone, and a total of 3,419 for 1826 through 1906. But this, mind you, was right in the midst of the notorious Stolypin reaction, a period for which an additional figure is available, 950 executions over a period of 6 months. In fact, the Stolypin military field tribunals were in existence for 6 months, all told. It sounds awful, and yet it does not make much of an impression on our hardened nerves, even if we multiply by 3 this figure of 950 for 6 months, in order to compare it with the Latsis figure for 18 months in the post-revolutionary period, we still come up with the fact that the terror after the revolution was at least 3 times more intense than Stolypin's. And that was for just 20 provinces and excluded courts and tribunals. And from November 1917 on, the courts acted on their own, despite all the difficulties at the time. Guiding principles of the criminal law of the RSFSR were issued for their use in 1919. We have not read this work, could not obtain it, and know only that it included imprisonment for an indefinite term, in other words, pending a special order. The courts were of 3 kinds, the People's Courts, the Circuit Courts, and the Revolutionary Tribunals, the Rev Tribunals. The People's Courts handled ordinary misdemeanors and non-political criminal cases. They were not empowered to impose death sentences, and, laughable as it seems, the People's Court could not, in fact, impose sentences exceeding 2 years. Up to July 1918, the heritage of the left SRs still endured in our judicial proceedings. Only by special intervention of the government, and only individually, were impermissibly lenient sentences raised to 20 years. From July 1918 on, the People's Courts were given the right to hand down sentences of up to 5 years, and in 1922, when all threats of war had died down, the People's Courts got the right to impose sentences of up to 10 years, and lost the right to sentence anyone to less than 6 months. From the beginning, the Circuit Courts and the Rev Tribunals had the power to impose the death sentence, but they lost it for a brief period, the Circuit Courts in 1920 and the Rev Tribunals in 1921. There were many tiny ups and downs in this period, which only a historian pursuing all the details of those years would be able to trace. Perhaps that historian will seek out the documents and unroll for us the scroll of tribunal sentences and also the statistics, though probably not. Whatever time and events failed to destroy was destroyed by persons interested in having such material disappear. We know only that the Rev Tribunals were not asleep. They were handing down sentences right and left. And we know, too, that every time a city was captured during the Civil War, the event was marked not only by gun smoke in the courtyards of the Cheka, but also by sleepless sessions of the tribunal. And you did not have to be a white officer, a senator, a landowner, a monk, a cadet, an SR, or an anarchist in order to get your bullet. Soft, white, uncalloused hands alone were sufficient in those years. But one can also hazard the guess that in Izhvesk or Votkinsk, Yaroslavl or Murom, Kozlov or Tambov, the uprisings were very costly as well to those who had calloused workers' hands. And if those scrolls of both the extrajudicial executions and those by tribunal are unrolled for us someday, the most surprising thing will be the number of ordinary peasants we find on them, because there was no end to the number of peasant uprisings and revolts from 1918 to 1921, even though they did not adorn the coloured pages of the official history of the Civil War, and even though no one photographed them, and no one filmed motion pictures of those furious crowds attacking machine guns with clubs, pitchforks, and axes, and later lined up for execution with their arms tied behind their backs. 10-1. The revolt in Saperjok is remembered only in Saperjok, the one in Pitalino only in Pitalino. We learn from Latsis the number of peasant rebellions that were suppressed during that same year and a half in 20 provinces, 344. From 1918 on, peasant revolts were already being called Kulak revolts. Well, how could the peasants revolt against the workers' and peasants' power? But how then could one explain that in every instance it was not just three peasant huts that revolted, but the whole village? Why did the masses of poor peasants not kill the insurgent kulaks with those same pitchforks and axes, instead of marching with them against the machine guns? Latsis claims, the kulaks compelled the rest of the peasants to take part in these revolts by promises, slander, and threats.